Hi everyone, this is Sim.
This is Ko.
And welcome to another episode of Work in Progress. We have another amazing guest with us today, Dr. Sana Balsari Polsule.
Today is a really special episode. It's our 12th episode. And it's the first time a guest has reached out to us to collaborate. A lot of it has been curated up until now. So since it's special, we wanted to do something different. And instead of us introducing in our monotone, we're going to hand over the baton to Sana and she can very graciously introduce herself.
Thank you. Firstly, I am thrilled to be here. So thank you for having me. So I am a social psychologist by training. And I guess the through line of the work that I've done, so I did my research at Cambridge, and the through line of the last kind of 10 years of my career has how can we take frameworks in psychology, in social psychology, in neuroscience, and translate them into actionable tools that we can apply in our daily lives. So I do that through writing, I do that through teaching, through designing and publishing games. I'm now writing a book. So I wear many hats, but I guess the thing at the core is how can we apply psychology to live, you know, better lives.
And in terms of your curiosity about it, what led you early on to be attracted or to want to pursue this in your life?
So I wish I could say that with psychology, I had this like aha moment when I was younger. But to be honest, when I, so it was like a week before I had to choose my final kind of subject and apply for university. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was doing literature, I was doing statistics, I was doing psychology. And my dad was the one who said, you know, Sana, you seem to be interested in human behavior. Maybe you'd be good, you know, being a psychologist. And I just kind of, I was very typically like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what to do. And I just said, okay, fine, I'll do it. And I loved it. But I think the turning point for me where I started specializing in personality psychology and social psychology was during my master's at Cambridge. I attended a lecture by my now kind of mentor and close collaborator, Brian Little. And he walked in and he was just very gregarious and he made so many funny jokes and made everyone laugh. And then at the end of that lecture, he revealed that he's actually a huge introvert, an extreme introvert. And the series of lectures after that were all around kind of how personality is malleable and how introverts can act extroverted for the sake of kind of the work that they do. Mm-hmm. And it really hit home because I'm someone who's always been more on the introverted side. I think now I'm maybe more in the ambivert category, and we can go into that in a bit. But I, you know, for me, being in a position such as a lecturer, teaching MBA students, which I do a lot, where they're typically like type A, quite extroverted, often quite male, actually dominated in those classrooms. I've had to learn how to be more assertive and be more kind of quote extroverted than I naturally am. Mm-hmm. And so attending this lecture and listening to someone who talks about the malleability of personality, when until that point, all I thought about was, you know, I'm the label that personality kind of generates. You are an introvert or you're an extrovert, and that's just how you are. And so that was just eye-opening. And after that, I just wanted to kind of research more. And so that was really the turning point for then specializing and becoming a kind of personality psychologist.
Yeah, and in terms of how we as everyday people look at personality and how someone who's specializing in it from a scientific or academic point of view, how does that actually differ in the way you've studied it?
Yeah, I think It speaks to my experience, you know, where I think in daily kind of in a daily common understanding of personality, we think of it as that label, as that category, introvert, extrovert. I think, honestly, when it comes to personality, from speaking to people, we don't really think beyond these labels. And from a scientific standpoint, personality, firstly, it's on a spectrum. So you can be kind of extremely introverted, somewhat introverted, but we don't think kind of in those terms, and we don't think about the nuances. You can be an extroverted introvert or an introverted extrovert. And then I think at the second layer is kind of building on what I mentioned about malleability. We don't think about the common understanding is not one of how we can change. It is just that, you know, we're born a certain way, or we, you know, through kind of adolescence, we pick up certain traits, and then those traits stay the same for your adulthood. And you can't really change. And that's something that my work, I really try and do with my work is to get people thinking about how they can change, right? And not to be disillusioned that they can't.
No, what you're saying really resonates, because like when you go in any office setting as well and like you're talking and everything, the label is straight put on to you, like, oh, you're such an extrovert, how do you do this? Oh, I never thought only you would think of yourself as an introvert. So yes, there is this extreme, whether it's this or that, but the spectrum aspect of how it could change really doesn't exist in the connotation of how you would define personality today. That's really interesting.
Absolutely. And I think this speaks to why we have to be careful when we're using personality assessments in hiring, recruitment, selection, because often you'll hire someone based on the fit that you think they will have with the role, their skills. But you could be, I'm using introvert and extrovert as an example because it's the easiest one, but you could be someone who is more introverted, but who can really excel in a leadership role because the traits that you have as an introvert, which are kind of listening more carefully, being a little less kind of risk-taking, being more risk-averse, you can blend those brilliant traits of being an introvert with picking up a couple of traits of a typically more extroverted person. So you could also be a bit more assertive at work. And then when you go home to your partner, or to your kids, to your friends, you go back to your natural self. So if you use these personality assessments, you miss out on the nuances and the beautiful kind of complexities of our personality.
And also, again, like in terms of how we consume it, you know, from BuzzFeed personality quizzes to intense ones where you have so many questions, I think it's our exposure, as I'm saying us as like laymen, are exposed to so many different connotations and understandings of it. And when I was doing research as well, one thing came up that in psychology, it's the least scientific sort of field because there's not one way. And like, what is your take on that as someone who is specializing in it? How has it changed over time, and how do you actually then assess and know when it's constantly evolving?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's changed a lot in the last kind of century. So I'll just go back a bit to kind of explain its evolution. So around the kind of early mid 19th century, where you had people like Carl Jung, William James, a philosopher. Personality was kind of early in its discovery, and it was very much so. Carl Jung, for example, saw personality as persona. So persona being the social mask that you wear to navigate the world. And then you have a shadow self, which is encompassing all your kind of hidden challenges, weaknesses, things like that. So that was kind of one conceptualization of it. Then you had Freud, who looked at personality as kind of the interaction of subconscious conflicts and things like that. But it was only around the 20th century that you had all these kind of prominent psychologists who unfortunately tended to be white male psychologists, who then started the scientific study of personality. And the main kind of development at that point was looking at personality, human personality, as being made up of traits. So to begin with, there were a number of different traits that psychologists kind of looked at. But then by the 1980s and 90s, there was kind of consensus that personality is made up of five traits. And these are known as the big five. And so it's, you know, across cultures, across individuals, across industries, you have these five key traits. Around then, there was also a controversy in personality science, just getting into the kind of nerdy side of things, where there was this personality situation debate, that's what it was called, where you had two schools of thought. On the one hand, psychologists were basically saying that our behavior is determined purely by our personality. On the other side were the situationists, who were saying our behavior is determined by our environment. And by things in our environment, social norms, how people behave. And so this went on for some time until a consensus was reached that was a much more kind of what we call interactionist perspective, that it's both. So our personality, our behavior is driven a lot by our personality, but it does also differ according to the environment that we find ourselves in. So that was kind of the middle ground. And that's where we're at today. So we see there's a level of stability in our personality. So we stay relatively the same, but we can change depending on the environment.
I think just to touch a note on culture, does that change? So for example, there's so many generalizations. So I can think of Japan, where everyone's like, oh, everybody is super respectful. You don't usually have an image of someone who's screaming and shouting or like boisterous, whereas maybe in Spain, you know, it's everyone's super loving and there's a certain tonality. So does that understanding change with different cultures, or is it broad generalizations and then it's adopted to sort of the place? Like, how do you look at it from a global?
Yeah, so in terms of the personality traits themselves, these five personality traits, they're universal, but it's the expression of them that changes from culture to culture. So Japan's a great example because their, you know, introversion is going to be much more normatively valued than extroversion in North America. So it's how that will shape how we express ourselves. But the traits themselves are the same across all.
Also, you mentioned about like personality and the study of it being driven by white males specifically. So I just wanted to ask you on that specifically, what do you think could have been changed, or what do you think has changed, or what perspective was missed because it was driven by these white males in the beginning, the study of personality?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at that time, I mean, it was just a reflection of
society
at that time. It did mean that the lens through which personality and behavior was kind of examined was through a very white kind of privileged lens, right? Yeah. and mindset. The good thing is that in the last kind of 30, 40, 50 years, it's evolved to the point where we can see, even though that was done with that lens, we now see those same findings replicated in other cultures outside of a typical kind of Western lens.
Yeah.
So the good thing is that has changed. And also we're seeing a lot more kind of the rise of female psychologists.
Yeah.
I don't think the ratio is fully balanced yet, and I think there's still a long way to go, but that's been a really positive kind of change.
Yeah. I think also to shift gears or double click a bit on personality assessment, like Simran mentioned earlier, application is across everywhere, right? Like dating apps, or if you're hiring
Spotify.
Someone, or in any conversation, it just helps to have these labels. And as an industry, it's supposed to double, triple. It's already $1 billion. One, what's your take on this commodification of personality assessment? And I think for me as well, in my first job, there was an event that happened where they applied Myers-Briggs to everybody. And it was my first actually exposure to it. And I thought, this is super cool. Like, I'm getting to know myself. And then I was exposed more and I realized, oh, this is not accurate. I'm not relating to it. And like you said, now it's the big five. So what's your take on where this is sort of going, and for corporates and for other organizations or companies that are like adopting it? How do you do it in a way that you're educating people, but you're also sort of being knowledgeable to what's out there?
Yeah, I think we're in a good place in that there are really robust, rigorous, scientific personality tests out there now.
Yeah.
And they are easily available and organizations are using them. Saying that, the Myers-Briggs is still the dominant model. Like, I teach a lot of senior level executives and I start my classes by asking them whether they've done a personality test, to raise their hand. And I ask them which one, and it's always the Myers-Briggs. Yeah. There are a few people who've done the big five, always the Myers-Briggs. And the problem with that is that, of, as you mentioned, right, it's not scientific in the slightest. It doesn't predict any outcomes. It has what we call low test retest reliability, which means if you did it today, you'd get different results if you did it next week.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not consistent. And it's putting people in categories without understanding what I mentioned before, that spectrum, right? That we do fall in a spectrum. So unfortunately, the Myers-Briggs is still dominating personality assessment. But I do think that it's better than it used to be because we have more access to better psychometrics now.
Also, just going off Ko's point, where like BuzzFeed, for example, Spotify, Netflix, even Instagram to a certain extent, I know that behavior is a part of personality, that it's a intertwined conversation, but like companies are increasingly using like AI, for example, to predict what you would do or what content you would like or what music you would like. And Spotify does this yearly Wrapped thing where like, oh, you see, and people enjoy it.
Yeah.
People seek out like these BuzzFeed quizzes. Oh, which Disney princess am I most like? And it's fun. So like, what do you think of like companies doing that? And do you, and also people are really enjoying them. So like, what does that even say about the psychology of people who keep reaching out to these things and wanting more of it?
I think it's just, it's a very natural kind of human impulse to want to understand ourselves better.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that with the rise of horoscopes in the last 20 years, right? I read some statistic about, it is from the CoStar CEO, CoStar being that astrology app, that 26%, something like 26 or 28% of women under 25 in the US have downloaded that app.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I know so many people amongst our circle only who use it on the daily.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that really speaks to this need that we have to understand ourselves, but also do it in a way that's easy.
And fun.
And fun. Exactly. And playful.
Also,
as well.
I think people want to feel seen. And I think like the rap makes you feel seen, right? Like, this is what I did. And like, that's also using data to make you understand yourself better. I think on an exciting lens, what really fascinated me and what I want to ask you is, like you said, there are so many personality tests out there. It's evolving so much. So what led you to, you know, identify some gap and then create your game? And like, please do talk about that, because we want to know. Continuing from a question, what do these tests help you do? And then what was your inspiration to create the game?
Yeah, so these help, I mean, as we've discussed, right, these tests help one understand like our behavior better, give us that label that helps us also understand each other as well. And I think I didn't mention, you know, why these things are so important as well, in that I think right now we're living in such a unstable, uncertain climate that we do need to latch on. I think it's very natural that we latch on to easy hooks to understand each other. It's comforting, actually, right? Labels are comforting. But the gap that I saw with the way that we currently talk about our personality and our behavior is that we don't discuss the tweaks and the modifications that we make to our behavior in different situations, in different roles, in different environments. Some of it is natural, some of it we're not even aware that we're doing. I, for example, am more assertive with my partner than I am in a workplace setting, which is an odd contradiction, right?
Yeah.
But there's a comfort level there where I don't have necessarily in a workplace setting. So I really wanted people to be able to see that for themselves. And it's not like everyone is going to score differently. So you might be the same person in your relationships, at work, and when you're by yourself. But I wanted to give people a chance to explore that and to learn more about those shifts that they make. And not just that, but also understand some kind of tips and guiding principles for if they want to change across them. And that's why I have this quite detailed kind of guidebook that I've included, where it has suggestions for, okay, if you are very naturally a people pleaser, but in your work you need to be taken seriously and you need to be quite assertive, what would that
look like?
Yeah. What strategies do you need to employ to actually do that?
Yeah, and that's so relatable, because this is something that I keep getting at work, which is, I keep getting told that I'm a lot more assertive or a lot more, sometimes not even approachable, but that's not how I identify myself. And then I have friends where it's like, okay, maybe I'm more sensitive, And then at home, I'm something else. And that for me has created a lot of dissonance of why am I doing this? And I guess what I'm hearing is that it is normal and it does happen. How do you kind of address that, or how do you normalize that? I don't know if that's the right word, but what's a helpful way of thinking about this? And also, why do we do this?
Like, also, I don't think you mentioned the name of your game. So,
yeah.
So I know we're talking about it. So I just wanted you to mention that it's Who Are You?
It is. Yes. So the game is, it's called Who Are You? And it is a science-based personality game. And it's 100 cards, and they're essentially all these like scenarios, and you can play it by yourself, you can play it in a group, you can play it with a partner. The whole idea of the design was to be really versatile, because I also want it to be something that people can play by themselves and learn about themselves as well.
Because like, just taking a cue from that is like, I wanted to ask, like, do you think people are more truthful when they're just answering by themselves or in like a group setting? So that would, I think, make a difference.
Exactly. And that I wanted people, because I do see that there is application and companies have used it, but it's a bit of a tough one, right? When you're doing this in a work setting or with your team, you might not feel as comfortable to be as truthful. So it depends.
And how did you design it? Like, how did you think of what's the format? Like, that's...
Yeah, it was a long, long process. I wrote hundreds and hundreds of scenarios that related to these big five personality traits. So that actually, going back to the big five, they are the foundation of this this game.
Can you explain?
Yes, exactly. I was just going to say. So there are five traits. One useful way to remember it is OCEAN. So the acronym OCEAN. So you've got openness to experience, which basically captures how curious and open to new experiences you are. It also captures your kind of intellectual imagination. So if you're high in that trait, those are the traits that you typically show and express. If you're lower, you tend to be more traditional and not like to kind of think out of the box. You like kind of tried and tested things. Conscientiousness, which is how, so if you're high in that, how goal-directed you are, you're more likely to stick to deadlines, and you like to be kind of organized. If you're on the other side of conscientiousness, I don't like the way that people typically think that negative means bad.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. It just means you're, so in the case of conscientiousness, maybe you're more laid back, you're more easygoing sometimes, because if you're high in conscientiousness, that can also mean perfectionism, which can sometimes be debilitating. Then you have extroversion, which we've discussed, but I think an important myth to debunk here is that being an introvert is not the same as shyness. It is more to do with our tolerance for stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So introverts, after, you know, a social gathering with lots of people, will not be able to kind of go to another one. They will maybe need to retreat, go home and kind of recharge, or they might not want to do kind of Friday, Saturday groups of new people. Whereas an extrovert thrives in that environment and will actually be energized by doing something like that. And then there's agreeableness, which captures how trusting you are, how warm you are. People who are lower in agreeableness don't have a hard time saying no, right? They're able to do that. And then finally, neuroticism. And neuroticism captures your emotional stability. So people who are higher in neuroticism tend to experience large emotional fluctuations. They tend to be more moody and more sensitive. Mm-hmm. And people who are lower tend to be more emotionally stable. So those are the kind of the big five.
One of the things that I wanted to double down on, and I think you're focusing on as well, is the dating sort of aspect of it. And I was just thinking, if we take the hypothesis that your personality is malleable and through experience it changes, how does that work in a relationship? So if you started off being introverted and then your partner is maybe extroverted, that rubs off on you. How does that change sort of happen? How do you cope with it? And
this was actually the part inspiration for my book, because I've, for some reason, and I feel like Jung or Freud would have lots to kind of deconstruct around this. I, as someone who is more introverted, have always dated extroverted people. Always. And I guess if you're coming from that Jungian kind of school of thought, it would be that maybe I'm in seeking to complete that aspect of myself, I don't really kind of buy into that. I think we don't really know. There's no one explanation for why this happens. And you have lots of people who date people who are very similar to their personalities. I'm just one of those who dates, you know, people who are the opposite. But I think what's more interesting about this is how that opposition can change your behavior over time.
Yeah.
And whilst our personality is relatively stable, I have noticed in myself that there are certain aspects of my personality and my behavior that now are that are different, right? I'm much more comfortable in social gatherings of people that I don't know than I would have been before. We recently was at a concert. And it was a gig, and the band asked, you know, people at one point, you know, get up and dance in your seats, or stand up and dance, and no one was doing it. And normally that's the kind of thing that I grew up in England. You're very kind of reserved, and like, you'll sit in your seat. But I was one of the first people to get up, and that was a really new thing for me. And so it is really interesting, even though we don't have the answers for how the dynamics actually play out, I think it is interesting to look at relationships and to see how we shape each other.
Yeah.
There's this phenomenon in relationship science known as the Michelangelo phenomenon. And it's about how couples sculpt each other towards their ideal self, which I find really interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're it's a nice analogy. You're kind of, in a good way, you're kind of chipping at each other to kind of bring the best version of themselves. Exactly.
Quite beautiful.
And also talk about relationships. You had a really fun article on the ick and how we need to think about that. And really, because everywhere like we go nowadays, this is a conversation we have at coffee with our girls. Oh, his feet are giving me the ick. Yeah. The nails are giving me the ick. So just like from a personality point of view, like how we might be deducing people to these certain things and then cutting them off. Like, why do you think you've reached that point? Maybe, and like your commentary on it overall.
I think social media has a lot to do with it. I would put the blame squarely on social media.
Fair.
TikTok, Instagram, people who are kind of putting out these bite-sized videos and drawing on psychological work, but in a very, very diluted way. And then coming up with these catchy terms. I mean, the ick is great. I totally understand why we use it. And I have caught myself using it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the reason. I think we are all watching the same content. That's then translating into the conversations we're having. The whole red flags and green flags.
And purple flags.
And purple flags and beige flags. And then you've got reality TV, like dating shows like Love is Blind, where they're repeating
these terminologies.
Lingo. Yeah. So I think we've just imbibed all of that and internalized
it. Adding on to that, then my question to you is, like, social media impacts our day-to-day life, like whether we like it or not, like we are constantly interacting with that. So how does that maybe impact our personality? And also, it's quite funny to think, because if you're going on Instagram, the algorithm is trying to gauge who you are and feed you content basis that. But then there's also content that you are seeing, then which is then impacting your personality. So it's like, oh, is the content I'm seeing really me, or the content that I'm seeing something that I will become? Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, because it's the aspirational self versus the natural self. Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting what's going on, because personality previously was a private thing. And now personality itself has kind of become commodified, and it's a brand now.
Yeah.
So there are certain traits that online or our digital kind of selves can accentuate.
Yeah.
And it's a very strange kind of evolution of the whole thing. So being, I think where we are now with social media is that being your authentic self has become the new kind of trend.
Yeah.
So you want to be your unfiltered self on social media, but then you're still on social media. So there is
it's still performative.
Yeah.
It's actually interesting because our previous conversation was with a digital anthropologist and we spoke to her about the multiple identities, right? And what I was thinking about was how is the identity then different from personality? Because online, you do want to imbibe, or rather for someone who's creative, it's great because I can do 10 things and have 10 identities and express myself. But how does that correlate maybe to my personality, or is it that the personality is deeper and this is just a way of expressing yourself differently? Like how does one actually think about that now? Correlate to, you know, the therapy speak that it's so prevalent on social media, you know, you'll see memes about having multiple personalities and people joking about it. Like, what's just your take on that?
Yeah, I think that particularly is quite dangerous, that type of narrative, because personality is relatively stable. So you don't have multiple personalities. You have that core personality. As you said, it is the expression that varies. So you could be someone who is naturally more withdrawn, but on social media you are, you know, commenting and, you know, a very different version of yourself. But that is not a change in your personality. And multiple personalities speaks more to the clinical side of things. And so it's quite worrying what's happening, especially on TikTok. Mm-hmm. The other one that I saw on TikTok is this whole notion of this shadow self that I mentioned, Jung's concept. And this is something that, you know, when we're talking about our shadow self, according to kind of that work, it's a lifelong journey and exercise. On TikTok, it's all about unlocking your shadow self through this 10-minute daily journaling practice.
And meditation routine.
Exactly. And I'm so sick of the hacks, you know, that terminology of how to hack your life, how to hack your fitness and mental health. And I think it's just so intrusive and also so damaging as well.
I found it really helpful when you said that your personality is stable, that doesn't change. So it just helps because a lot of times it's confusing, right? Like the idea of being performatively authentic. Like I just accepted you cannot be. Like there is some amount of performance even for you if you're, you know, working towards the book release that's coming, you will have to put yourself out there, which typically might be extroverted traits that you might not want to do. But I feel this myth busting on certain things are stable and there's a difference. I think that content needs to be more out there instead of mixing these things together.
And also, like, I think you touched upon it a little, but like this constant need to like self-improve, right? Like, and that's the content we are being fed. And I think you wrote about it also that it needs a software update.
Yeah.
So like, oh, you're constantly being thrown these content pieces. Okay, 10 ways you can change your life in XYZ way. And like, then it really starts playing on your mind and you may be even doing those things, but you might not even be seeing the results because it's just like 30-second content videos that you're seeing, which is trying to pull you in, but maybe not given the context of who you are as a person. It's a very generalized point of view that they're putting out on videos.
Exactly. And it's so surface level. And there's so much of it that it's actually really overwhelming.
Yeah.
And I think more than anything, it's also so much of this content is not based in scientific evidence.
Yeah.
So it's just peddling these things. Like, for example, there's so much out there on habits. Habits became, you know, a thing that everyone wanted to know about, how to optimize your habit and all of this. But to actually sustain a habit takes so much work, right? It requires a rewiring of all these like deep set patterns. But you have books where it says, articles and videos, 21 days, to change, you know, all your habits.
If you do it for 30 days straight, then it's a habit for life.
All of that. it's very damaging.
True. I actually wanted to double click on this fluidity of personality. I think you hear it a lot. Actually, for me, it was the first time that I was reading about the fact that you can change your personality, not in a, like she said, positive hack way of, you know, do these things and you'll change it or change these patterns, but that you actually quite literally can. So does it change over time? Are certain traits fixed? Like, are you born with some? Does experience change that? How does it really work? Do you focus on what I want to be? Like, how do you really understand that? And I did read about the maturity principle, but I would love for you to explain it better.
Sure. It's a big topic, but I'll do my best to kind of explain some of the key principles around it. So there are two types of change in personality. One is, as you mentioned, the maturity principle. So that's when how we naturally change over time. So the maturity principle is capturing the fact that we naturally become more conscientious as we get older, we naturally become more agreeable as we get older and less open, which makes sense. As you get older, you're less kind of open to trying kind of new things.
Yeah.
But then the second type of change is what we call kind of volitional change. So that's change that comes from your intention and your kind of motivation. Now, we can change each of those five traits that I talked about. It's not that we can change one more than the other, but it requires hard work and it requires the scientific kind of strategies that have been kind of understood over the last few decades for how to actually do that. One thing that's quite helpful is thinking about it like a habit. And so, for example, if you're someone who is not very conscientious, but for work, you need to improve your conscientiousness. There are certain things that you can do that help with that. So for example, one thing that we typically do when we think about change is we think of it in this very broad brush way. I just want to be more conscientious. But what's really helpful is to actually add a very important layer of specificity of what is the actual change that I want to see?
Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to stick to my goals at work, right? And then have that as the
guiding
goal.
Yeah.
And the guiding principle.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one thing that's quite helpful. The other is to have, a support system to help keep you accountable for that. I think typically we don't think of personality change in that habit terminology, but actually you can overlay that and it can be really, really helpful.
Yeah. And to that, again, taking from popular culture, where there's this idea, quite successful or not, where if I want to get better at my confidence, just fake it till you make it and just keep telling yourself, and that works out, or at least that's what you see. Right?
You'll eventually
work out. It'll eventually work out. So can that, like acting your way into something, actually change it from a deeper personality level? And does that affect you physically? Like, does that have changes in you, good or bad? Like an introvert who really needs that time and then has to force themselves, like, does that have any sort of impact in the way they function?
Yeah, I love this because this is the heart of my research. So yes and no. For some people, going back to the introvert example, being more extroverted day in and day out, it is going to take a toll. It is going to take a physical toll. So there's research that supports that kind of suppressing aspects of ourselves increases kind of our heart rate and blood pressure. So there's a physical side of it, and of course stress. There's a psychological side where, it can increase imposter syndrome, right? Because you're being someone that you're not naturally.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the negative side of it. However, you can also be someone who's doing this day in and day out, and in the same way you kind of build muscle, it becomes second nature to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you will have introverts who have been acting extroverted in leadership, managerial positions for decades. And now it's just like a switch on and off, right? At work, they are this person, they leave the office, and then they go back to being their natural selves.
Yeah.
Of course, it takes practice, and not everyone experiences that. There are people who have to do that and who will burn out.
Yeah.
So I can't, there's no kind of
way. But it's so interesting because my mentor is highly extroverted and, she has that energy, and she always says this, that it's a switch on and switch off. And I can't believe that because I'm like, how does that work? You're so on it. And she's like, but I like nothing more than my alone time. And that always caused some dissonance in me. So to that, can you also explain this idea or concept of having or maintaining a restorative niche?
Yes. Yes. So this is the work of Brian Little, who talked about this need to, so when we are acting out of our natural selves. In the case of introversion and extroversion, we need personality specific spaces or activities that will take us back to our natural self. So, and what's interesting about these is they differ across personality. So if you are an extrovert who is having to work for long periods alone, so you're actually missing that interaction that gives you energy, your restorative niche will be to go spend time with people. For an introvert, it's going to be the opposite. It's going to be spending time alone. So what's helpful about restorative niches is that they're essentially kind of, we can think of them as breaks for our personality. And they can be really helpful for people who do find themselves acting kind of out of character.
Yeah.
And when you talk about burnout and like, because when you think of burnout, you think of like, oh, I'm working so hard and now I'm burning out. Like what does like a personality, when you're burning out, like from what you're saying, like how does that manifest itself? What does it look like? So people could maybe recognize it in themselves.
Yeah, I think it's the feeling of, I think it goes back to imposter syndrome. I think it's feeling like you are putting on such a mask and you have no one who you can kind of go to be your natural self. And that's where having, you know, a colleague who can be a confidant or just you can be yourself with, you can go out for lunch and just be yourself with is so important. Because I think that people who are really stretching themselves, who are behaving, if we think about personality as a spectrum, who are on the other extreme, that distance is what can push someone towards burnout. Whereas someone who is maybe just kind of modifying or being a little more assertive than they naturally are may not feel that burnout because it's just not so extreme.
Like when you spoke about imposter syndrome, like I think again it's spoken about so much. Why do you think as a concept is romanticized as well a lot, right? Like
And said so casually.
Any great entrepreneur or in just general popular culture, you'll find people being like, oh, I have a massive imposter syndrome. While understanding or not understanding it, debatable. But why do you think that that's...
It's the same reason that we're using the other terms. I think we have this tendency to, as a collective, latch onto these terms. Like, for example, going back to relationships, gaslighting.
Yes.
So it's like overnight, we all woke up and started using gaslighting.
No, 100%.
And I find it bizarre because it's like we go through cycles of these terms also. So it's actually all changing pretty quickly. Like, I at some point, these flags are going to end and it'll be replaced by something else. So I don't know, but like, we have them for the workplace. We have them for our relationships. Yeah. We have them for ourselves. Yeah.
I think it's the same, tying it back to the same idea of wanting to understand ourselves and each other better and a common term so that we're on the same page. Again, while doing research, and I think it was in one of your articles about how Hitman, the movie, was a great example of having different personas and it coming together. And I think that might help people understand it too. So what was your sort of understanding of?
Yeah, so I thought Hitman was really helpful in a very extreme portrayal of how through taking on different personas, we do end up changing certain aspects of ourselves. So this is a very extreme version, of course, because he's like a Russian gangster one day. And he's like a nerd
with
another.
Long hair.
Yeah, exactly. So very extreme. But it was the first time that you saw the complexity of how that over time starts changing him as a person. He becomes more confident.
Yeah.
He becomes, more self-assured. So I found that's why I kind of drew on that, because it was a really interesting portrayal of that.
Put on.
And also I feel, just wanted to ask you a question, because we talk about like multiple identities, multiple personas, etc. And we have a base understanding of it. But I feel like sometimes, not very easily, but people confuse it with like more clinical things like multiple personalities, and the way the verbiage is used might be very different. So if you could maybe explain the difference a little so people could even get that.
Yeah, so I think a helpful way to think about this is persona is the, let's say, the mask you adopt when you are engaging in any given situation. So at work, you are persona A, and in your relationship, you're persona B. But your personality is your core traits. Mm-hmm. That does not change significantly, but you can also change that over time.
Yeah.
But it's that's why I always say kind of relatively stable.
Yeah.
It's I don't like, the problem is that people tend to think it's entirely fixed. It is not fixed, but it's relatively stable. So it's important to get that nuance, to know that you can change, but you're generally the same.
Yeah. And like an interesting analogy. So for example, if I do want to get more confident in my life, and that's very, again, action-oriented, I put myself in those situations. But at the same time, and so that's a new trait that I'm adding. But at the same time, I know I'm anxious and that's preventing me. So that's a trait I want to dial down. So of course, the therapy helps and, you know, the 100 things. But how do you actually go about doing something like this? Like, I want to add a new trait, but I also know I need to dial something down. And, you know,
it could be counterintuitive.
Yeah, it could be counterintuitive. Like, how does that sort of work? Also keeping in mind the identity personality thing, that some of it, you just need to do it as an identity, you know, you put it on. But some of it is really core. So how does one actually, you know, tackle that?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So I'll say a few things. I'm glad you brought up the example of anxiety, because neuroticism, changing our neuroticism and becoming less anxious, is one of the most common goals.
Yeah.
So we call them change goals in psychology, personality psychology. What's interesting about it is that there have been a bunch of clinical studies where they found that neuroticism through therapeutic interventions like CBT does actually decrease over quite a short span. It can decrease over kind of 16 weeks, and it can stay at that level. So it sustains over time. So neuroticism is one that we see therapy is really kind of helpful. In terms of kind of increasing versus decreasing, it is always easier to increase a trait, to add onto a trait, because it's psychologically, you already have a baseline, but you're building on it.
Yeah.
It's psychologically much more stressful to be reducing a trait. So, you know, I need to be less anxious is what we call like an avoidant framing. Versus, I want to be more confident, which is an approach framing.
Can you explain that more?
Yeah, so it's another good example where I use approach and avoidant is in goals. So when we, let's say we're writing our New Year's resolutions, if I write this year, I want to be more of, I want to be a better friend. Versus this year, I want to avoid hurting hurting my friends. That simple, like, little tweak in phrasing can actually affect the way that we view that goal and actually make progress towards that goal.
And perceive it. And maybe it's a little more positive versus a little more negative.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it is always going to be easier to be more, to build rather than take away. Taking away and suppression is much more difficult and taxing, actually, to really suppress ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of, like, again, let's say with therapy, a lot of times, my understanding or my experience, a lot of times if something really massive happens, then you kind of realize that I need to make a change, or, you know, it shocks your system and you want to make a change, as opposed to where a bit laid back about daily things, you know. Yes, I have 10 things I want to do, but if something jolts my world, then I need to get into it. So again, relating it back to personality and changes you want to make, is that how it works? Or can you also have a helpful way of thinking of it on a day-to-day basis?
It's both. So you can, I think we should build awareness of the fact we can change on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes time, but we can make those changes in our daily life. Unfortunately, we don't have the awareness that we do that. So that's why something like this, what we're doing today, is really helpful, right?
Yeah.
Going back to the first point on events, big events, when it comes to things like a breakup or when we go through unexpected kind of grief and bereavement, those are the times that we experience the most kind of externally imposed change in ourselves. Some of it can be positive. So, for example, kind of research on people after relationship breakups has found that people tend to be more open. They tend to try new things. They also experience the most personal growth after a breakup, which is quite intuitive. Yeah. And then, of course, when you have things like grief, people can suddenly can become a lot more neurotic, can become a lot more withdrawn and removed as well. So these big events do have the power to change us.
That.
Yeah.
And on that, like, if I want to get to know myself better and, you know, I try to understand through the lens of the big five traits, and because as a product of just who I am, I'm high on neuroticism, I'm high on other things. And how do you have that framing? Like, you beautifully said, there's no negative, positive, but it's very easy for someone who doesn't know to feel like, shit, like, you know, this is, I'm not scoring good on this, mm-hmm. versus like accepting that this is just who I am and I can change it if I want to. Like, how does one approach it?
Yeah, so I want to say before I answer that on neuroticism, I didn't talk about the positive things. So neuroticism, so if you're high in neuroticism, you tend to be more sensitive to other people's emotions. So you actually pick up emotional cues in people. You're more observant to their emotions, which is a really great thing. Also, people high in neuroticism tend to, these are generalizations, but they tend to have a really good sense of humor. So like Larry David from Curb, good example of kind of high neuroticism. I think when it comes to changing our traits, to looking at our traits and that, as you described, right? How do we make sure that we're not feeling kind of lost?
Inadequate.
Yeah, inadequate. I think firstly, it's just important to know that, you know, everyone is a work in progress. and these traits, yes, they are deep set patterns that have been kind of internalized over time, but that there are ways to reduce or improve or, you know, change them. So with neuroticism, because that's the one that I think is the most common, we do know that therapy can be a really, really helpful tool for doing that. I think it also has to come from a place, I think when change comes from a place that is external, it's very stressful and very difficult to do. But when you see your change as a facilitator for reaching a goal or for being the best version of yourself, then that is it's easier to achieve.
Yeah.
So I think those two things, plus what I always kind of talk about, is just self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about change as if it's something that we can do, and we can do it.
Yeah.
But it's not easy by any means. It takes people years to break these patterns, and it's very rewarding when they do, but it really takes a lot of time. So we need to be compassionate to ourselves that, you know,
it's going to take time
and like give ourselves a break. And
I know it's easier said than done to give yourself a break, but it gets a lot. But what you're saying about the framing aspect of like just how you frame your goals or the things that you want to change, that's just a simple thing that people can take back and really like that work on.
And I mean, related to this, what would be certain things that you would want to just myth bust for people? Like basic things that
like
you
think.
Like
how you said personality is a spectrum.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Stuff
yeah.
like
that.
That
would help them make positive change.
So the first, we spoke about introverts not being shy, right? That I think that can be quite a harmful bias that people carry about introverts. It has changed over time. I think we are talking more about the power of introversion and the strengths of introverts, but I do feel like there's still this advantage that we give to extroverts, where if you're the loudest person in the room and you are the most kind of dominant, then you must be the most competent, which I think is a really important myth to bust. Another one would be, we've also spoken about that personality is not cannot be categorized in this very like
hard
cut and dry way. Yeah, exactly. Personality falls on a spectrum. There is no positive, like black and white, positive and negative for each of these traits. And I'm glad we got to talk about neuroticism, because I think, you know, people don't tend to think of that as having.
Yeah, no, when you just think
type.
Of the word, you think of it as a negative thing.
I actually was hearing a podcast. For people, and that it's quite famous, and there was a psychologist to just understand. And she spoke about the big five traits, and the person taking the interview was like, oh no, the same reaction what I told you. So yeah, I think people do
that. Because like people say, oh, you're being neurotic. Like the way you frame those things in everyday language is only so negative. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's why these myths are being perpetuated, because we're using these terms so freely, like neurotic, that but without an understanding of what that actually is.
And what that actually means.
Yeah,
for sure.
And if, again, like for someone who wants to know, are there any specific, of course you are writing a book, so we would want to know more about that, but are there other things that they can, you know, expose themselves to understand their personality better and also understand people around them better and the world better?
There's a great book that's come out called Be Who You Want by Christian Jarrett, and he summarizes the big five, but also how to change personality.
Yeah.
So that's a really good example of that. There's so what's great is there's so many podcasts and books that have come out. For those who are more introverted amongst your listeners, I always recommend a book by Susan Cain called Quiet, but she also has a TED Talk, which has been viewed like 30 million times, which is just a lovely solace to people who, to introverts who feel like they've been kind of overlooked. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very positive kind of look at that. And then, you know, platforms like Psychology Today, like we're seeing a rise in articles and content that is tackling this or kind of addressing the fact that we can change.
Yeah.
That's increasingly out there, which is really great.
Yeah.
My book is going to focus specifically on relationships, and we're going to dive into, you're building on what we talked about, this whole like TikTok social media stuff. So I'm bashing that a lot in the first part of the book. And then I focus specifically on compatibility, because we're fed all of these really unhelpful narratives of what it means to find our person.
Like a puzzle piece.
Exactly. So I have one chapter which is on the puzzle piece mindset, which is what I call
it. Like you're getting something which does not exist.
Exactly.
In you.
Exactly. And we romanticize it, right? Like that someone is going to complete us. And then the romantic like comedies we watch just kind of accentuate that even more. But the fact of the matter is that because we can naturally change, we can actually create compatibility. Compatibility is not something
that you get on day one.
Yeah, exactly. So you can be quite different to your partner on a number of things, but then over time in that relationship, you build compatibility.
Like you were saying, mold each other to maybe what you would need in the relationship from both ends.
Exactly.
And on this front, like I was just thinking, I recently listened to a lot more, so Mel Robbins or Gabo
Mate.
There's another, I forget his name, I think Matthew, and he calls himself relationship expert. What is just your take? Because there's another doctor that calls himself the brain rot doctor, which I'm assuming it's also because that verbiage is so out there. So it's kind of like intention. You want to avoid doing it, but that's the only way people pay attention. So
it goes back to, you know, using social media as a tool. I've stayed away from using it as a tool as a psychologist, but my editors are now telling me that I'm going to have to in the lead up to the book's release. I have to. So it's a double-edged sword. I don't have the perfect solution for it, and I see why people are calling themselves dating coaches and using things like brain rot or hacking,
or like the number one way to fix a relationship, which, to be fair, works, because people will, that you're so online firstly, and if you see, you want it in the simplest way possible, right? But yeah, as a purist, what is your...
I think that through this conversation, I've been kind of speaking from the one perspective of, it's not helpful because it's diluting all of this. But I think I haven't spoken about the fact that it is a good thing that we are discussing mental health, that we are bringing these theories into conversation. We've never done that before, and this generation is doing that. And I think that is really helpful. So it's really about how do we find the balance where on TikTok, on social media, we have experts doing that. It will have to be bite-sized content because our attention spans are that way now, unfortunately. But it is important. I think it's just a reality that we're going to have to
do. But like just finding a balance of how to give what's missing is context, right? Yeah. And like giving people, disclaimer is a harsh word, but giving people like the context and disclaimer that yes, this is what I'm going to help you with, but these are 1, 2, 3, 4 things you need to think about.
Yeah.
Before like you really like embrace whatever I'm telling you.
Yeah. And that these are generalizations.
Yes.
And they will not necessarily apply to every situation or to every person or to their, because we all come with our own history and background.
Our own baggage.
Yeah. And so these principles, it can be quite, like, I worry about younger people who read or consume this content and they can't see themselves, they can't make those changes. They don't feel like they can because of XYZ.
Yeah.
It can be so demotivating
for
them.
It can make a person more anxious because you're seeing it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
But also, I just want, all this leads up to basically your game only, right? Like, we are talking about, like, personality, how it's malleable, like, how, like, personality assessment can be good, but can be bad. But, like, you are trying to take something that is scientific and make it more accessible, more fun. But in doing so, I just wanted to get your perspective. Like, you are taking something like the Big Five and applying it with prompts that could make it more fun for us to use in a group, for example. So what was something maybe that was challenging for you when you were doing this process?
Exactly what we were just speaking about, where I had to make these scenarios quite general.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was doing like my play testing of the game, you know, I had people say, but I'm not A, B, or C. I'm D, E, F, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to keep saying to them, yes, but for the sake of the game, I need to have only three options. But I did find that really difficult because I had to categorize behavior into three categories. Even though that, you know, I'm trying not to do that.
Were there any scenarios or like questions that you wanted to include but like refrain from maybe because it was getting too much or like, I don't know?
Not necessarily that, but what I did do, which I now look back, I wish I hadn't done, is that I tried to keep it very PG and keep them very kind of scenarios that are not too controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But now looking back and like also seeing people interact with the game, I think we like that. I mean, why do we like Cards Against Humanity?
Yeah.
We like to be challenged a bit with a situation. Exactly.
That actually reminds me of, it's completely different, but it's the same audience. So when you said card game, the first thing that came to my mind was We Are Not Really Strangers, right? Because everyone uses it to connect and there's a relationship version and all of that. And I think that's a lot of people's understanding and it does help.
Yep.
So given that is the playground, like how do you feel about, you know, your game and like explaining that it is a bit more scientific and, you know, we've attempted, tell us a few questions and, you know, what you've put down so people can understand how it's different.
Yeah, I definitely took a bit of a gamble with making it quite science-based because I was quite worried when I was doing that. And we have this guidebook with, you know, all the instructions for understanding yourself. I was a bit worried that people wouldn't have the attention span for it. Mm-hmm. They want something a lot easier. But actually, I've been quite pleasantly surprised because I think because we do all these personality tests ourselves, this game essentially represents a form of personality test, but in a play form.
Mm-hmm.
And people really, when they're sitting down and playing a game by themselves or with others, they have the time and the mindset to read and to like to actually
and disconnect and really talk about things.
And I think that's a huge, like, for people our age and younger, you want to detox, right? You want to deeply
go
connect
offline.
And then connect.
I think it's the best time to actually do that or position it as, because you're looking for it. Like
we constantly do it amongst our friend circle. Like we'll sit and we'll be asking these questions. We'll check who are we, strangers. And even though we know the answer, we know it's going to change. We'll ask it again and again.
I think that's a big demand from people for it. It's,
Also, before we get into like checking any scenarios, etc., you had mentioned on your LinkedIn post that you had included, while you're saying it's PG, you had said that there are some not so safe for work questions or scenarios. Is there any fun ones you can share with us?
So that was because, so I had put that on LinkedIn.
It was a proper disclaimer, so I thought I'd ask about it.
So I put it on LinkedIn because I I've tagged them in the game, the relationship ones, and I didn't want people kind of opening it up in like a team lunch and then asking themselves about, oh, do you want to be in an open relationship?
Yeah.
So that, I mean, they're not that racy, to be honest. It's just like a couple where I go into kind of, your partner comes to you and says, you know, the sex has become a bit stale and I'm thinking we should maybe consider opening up our relationship. How do you feel? Mm-hmm. And then it has, you know, some options there. So that was, I just tagged it for that.
Yeah. And do we want to get into something?
Yeah, I can do. So I've got three that I can do. And these are based on introversion and extroversion. So the extroversion trait. The first one being, you are on a walkthrough in a gallery, in an art gallery. And you have a question about one of the pieces and the paintings in front of you. Do you, A, ask your question to the guide there and then? Do you, B, wait until someone else has asked a question and then ask your question with the group around you? Or do you, C, wait until the group has disbanded and at the end of the walkthrough, ask the person your question?
I think I'm B, most likely.
Can I tell you, I would whisper it to my friend and if they didn't know, then I would ask the question. But if I didn't have anyone, I would ask the question. Like, yeah. I would raise my hand, but I would first be like, and then.
So this is what happens when people play the game. It's like, oh, I wouldn't do any of these. I would do this. But it's helpful to do that. So A was, by the way, if you're extroverted, because it doesn't matter how many people are around you.
Yeah.
B is you're kind of an ambivert in the middle,
yeah.
And then C is you're more introverted. It's your birthday and your friends have organized a dinner for you at a restaurant and they call the waiters over to come wish you and get the entire restaurant to sing happy birthday to you. Do you A, love it? You love being the center of attention. B, feel slightly embarrassed, but it's your birthday after all. Or C, hate it. You hate the spotlight.
B.
I feel like I would love it.
You would love it.
That's the energy.
Fair. I think also this, because it's a birthday, sometimes people can be a B,
yeah,
but be like, I'm going to lean into this. And it's
yeah.
A. Yeah. Okay, the last one. So you're having an argument with your partner in a cafe. There's a couple next to you that appears to be listening. And you're having a very intense argument with your partner. Do you A, speak your mind anyway? You don't feel easily embarrassed. Do you B, find it a little awkward? So kind of lower your voice. Or do you C, insist on waiting till you get home? Because you need that time to process and you can't do it.
C. B or C.
B or C.
Definitely
I think
not.
C,
yeah. See, I've dated people who are firmly A's and it is so frustrating.
It's like,
yeah,
chill.
I wouldn't be able to process. So I would just be like,
yeah.
No, I wouldn't
yeah.
be listening to what you're saying only. So even if you're arguing, you'd be arguing at a wall
yes.
because
I'm just silent.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, fun. Yeah. And so usually when people play it, is it clear, like, ambivert, extrovert, introvert, that's how you...
It is in the guidebook. So again, I've had to simplify it.
Yeah.
You might be A/B, B/C.
But you're divided into categories, right?
But I've divided into categories just so that it's easier.
Yeah.
This is not a game the way that a personality assessment is going to give you the real scientific measurement. This is not a scientific... that level of kind of rigor, but it gives you an indication. I think that's how I would look at it.
I think to wrap, we wanted to, one, of course, ask you how you were work in progress, how is the work you do a work in progress? And I think doubling down on anyone who wants to understand beyond books and podcasts, what are just helpful ways of trying to understand yourself better? Like, what could you do maybe as dating habits or to get attention more towards yourself? Like, what is it that you could do?
I think firstly, going back to how we started, which is the personality assessments, I think it is really helpful to do these, and I would steer away from the BuzzFeed quizzes, but yeah, but for example, the Big Five, and you get 10 question versions, you get 150 question versions. There's a psychometric tool out there called Principles U, which is really cool because it puts you into personas, like archetypes, and that's quite a fun way of understanding yourself. There's a bunch of really good stuff out there. So I would say that is the starting point. But then, as we've talked about, kind of also that awareness that you know, we are not these fixed entities, and that there are resources out there to kind of help guide us towards that kind of meaningful change. In terms of my, I guess, affinity to the work in progress thing, I think it speaks so, like, it ties in so beautifully to this topic of malleability.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's a quote by Walt Whitman, which is something like, we are many, you know, we contain multitudes. Mm-hmm. And I think going back to the idea of personality, you know, we do have this core, and it does express itself in our relationships and in our work lives and in our daily lives. But we are always going to be works in progress, and we're always going to be shaping ourselves. At least this is how I see it with myself, like, always shaping myself to be the best version. And I don't think I subscribe to the every day is a blank slate, mm-hmm. because that's, I think, a little too idealistic, given that we have all these patterns of behaving. But I think every day is like a quarter blank slate,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
I think that's my more realist kind of take on it.
Vision,
yeah, and we're always going to be those works in progress.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll ever achieve that perfect self, mm-hmm. because the perfect self does not actually exist.
Yeah. And what would make you happy or satiated with the game and with the book coming out in terms of, like, feeling proud? Like, what would that look like?
I think recently, while I've been, you know, speaking to people about my book and this whole notion of compatibility, and having people see themselves in the new frameworks that I'm presenting, in mm-hmm. the idea that we can create compatibility, and having people share their experiences and feel reassured,
yeah.
has been so wonderful already. And I think I'm really excited about the book, because the ability to hopefully reach people at scale,
mm-hmm.
where these frameworks replace the more reductionist frameworks that
yeah.
we've been kind of internalizing, that would be amazing for me.
Yes.
No, that's amazing. That really sounds like through this conversation, I've genuinely, like, learned a lot and, like, understood, like, how to look at my personality also in a different way. So, like, what you're saying really resonates with us as a whole.
I think I've had the most fun researching for this, because I also feel I had the same question a week before, why am I different people and what does that mean and how do you understand that? Permeates across all aspects, and I think everyone, more so in and around our age, who's exposed to this world of content and
thinks about
so online, yeah, thinks about and is a bit helpless.
Mm.
So we really need more things like that just to challenge our thinking
and have a structured conversation about it.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. So I would love for more and more and more of this to come up. I'm really excited about reading your book and playing the game.
Yeah, no, for sure. And also, if our listeners want to find you anywhere, like, follow your work, want to find your book, etc., let them know where they can find you, like, your social handles, etc.
Yes. So on Instagram, I mean, as I said, I'm now building this up because I have to. So you can find me at Dr. Sana Balsari. And there should be a link to the game there also. You can get it on Amazon.
Yes.
And it's, yeah, and then I've got some more resources there as well. And then I have a column on Psychology Today that if your readers are interested, they can go to that as well.
That column is amazing.
Great. Thank you so much.
Genuinely, it was so glad you reached out. It was a really amazing conversation. Learned a lot.
I think learned a lot. And we will continue to engage with you, I'm sure, with our questions. And we're going to play the game. And we'll do some more content about it as well. But really grateful that you did come.
Thank you.
And we've learned a lot.